सर्वां कुञ्जविहारी माधव कुञ्ज विहारी गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी गोपी जन गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन गौन किरा वनचारी गौन किरा वनचारी जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी माधव कुंज विहारी गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी गोपी जन गोपी जन वल्लभा गिरिवर धारी यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यशोदा नंदन व्रज जन रंजन यमुनातीरा वनचारी यमुनातीरा वनचारी जय राधा माधव कुंज विहारी राधा माधव कुंज विहारी जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज काचार्य सरस्वती श्रीमती भक्ति विरांत स्वामी प्रभुपाद की जाए इस कॉन्फाउंडर आचार्य श्री प्रभुपाद की जाए जय विष्णुपाद परमहंस परिव्राज काचार्य सरस्वती श्रीमद भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर की जाए अनंत गौती वैष्णव वृंद की जाए नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जाए प्रेम से कहो श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री द्वैत गदाधर श्रीवास आदि गौर भक्तवृंद की जय श्री श्री राधा कृष्ण गो गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंद राधा कुंद गिरि गोवर्धन की जय वृंदावन धाम की जय मायापुर धाम की जय जगन्नाथ स्वामी की जय गंगा मई की जय जमुना मई की जय तुलसी देवी की जय भक्ति देवी की जय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय All glories of the assembled devotees. Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol. So, first number is that?
2746.
Devai Vidanti Atitaranti Chadeva Maya. So that means Tevai, they indeed, Vidanti, understand. This is the root vid, from which you get the word Veda. Just so you know what you're chanting. Tevai Vidanti, they indeed know Atitaranti. And they cross over. Ati means over, and taranti means cross. It's the same root from which you get like Prabhupada's mantra, Paschatya Desha Tarine, the one who takes the Western countries across from the material plane to the spiritual platform. So, Tevai Vidanti, they indeed understand, and they cross over Deva Mayang, which I'm sure you understand, one of our intimate associates. The Lord's Maya, the more Lord's illusory potency. Sri Shudra Puna Shabara Api Papa Jiva. So, Sri, women, Shudra, you know, Shudras, Huna, Huns, the terrible Huns. Shabara, another, Prabhupada says, Siberians. Not very advanced people. Api indeed, papa jivaha, and sinful lives, those who have sinful lives, papa jivaha. So, Sri Shudra Huna Shabara Api Papa Jiva.
Sri Shudra Huna Shabara Api Papa Jiva.
Yadi Adbhuta.
Yadi Adbhuta.
Krama.
Krama.
Parayana.
Parayana.
Shila.
Shikshas.
So yadi means if adhuta krama parayana. Krama actually in Sanskrit means a step, and for example Krishna took three great steps, therefore he's called tri vikrama. V means wide, in this case tri vikrama, that's a reference to Vamana, also called Uru Krama. And if you know Jiva Goswami's famous verse, Adosha Dha Tatak Sadhu Sangha, in the beginning faith and so on, at the end he says, Bhaved Krama, this must be the steps, or these must be the steps, Krama. So just like in English, step can also mean a process, take different steps. And so here, Adhuta Krama is actually a reference to Lord Vamana. Again, Adbhuta means amazing. So the Lord who took amazing steps as Lord Vamana. So Adbhuta Krama, Parayana means devoted to. Literally it means Parayana, just Para of course means supreme, and Ayana means going. So it means going to someone as the supreme. So taking something as most important in your life. So Adbhuta Krama, Parayana, those who take the Lord who took amazing steps as supreme. Shila means behavior. By the way, Shalagram Shila, the word Shila means stone, and Shila means it means behavior, conduct, character. So here is, so Shila, and then Shiksha of course means instruction or teaching, as in Shikshamrita. So a person whose study, whose understanding, and whose conduct is all based on devoting oneself to the Lord who took amazing steps. That's what this sort of deluxe compound means. So, Yadyad Bhuta Krama Parayana Shila Shikshas. Tiryagjana api kimu shuta dharanaje. So tiryag is a word for animal, It also can mean sideways, like we say in English, something went sideways. So, in other words, it's kind of outside the proper path. So tiryag means animals. So tiryag jana, animal people. It's interesting, they're also called jana, from the root jan, to take birth, like janma, janmastami, from which we get English words like generate and so on. So, tiryag jana, sideways people, or animals. In other words, animals, those who are outside the path of human life. Api, even people who have taken birth as animals. Kimu in Sanskrit is a way of saying what to speak of, or not to speak of. What to speak of, shuta dharana jay. Prabhupada explains the word dharma, comes from the root dhara, which means to hold, to sustain. Like Krishna is called, for example, Chakradhara, the one who holds the chakra, or Gadadhara, the one who holds the gada, the club. And so here, Dharana, which is also, as you probably know, the sixth stage of Ashtanga Yoga, because the fifth stage of Ashtanga Yoga is Pratyahara. Pratyahara, and Pratyahara means reversing. So the senses are going out into the world, so you reverse that and bring the mind inwards to the soul. So that's called pratyahara, and then you have to hold on. So dharana there, the sixth stage of yoga, just means holding on. And so here, shuta dharana, those who hold what they have heard, literally. And of course, shuta is a reference to the Vedas. Shuta is a reference to the Vedas, that which is heard, shruti, shuta. So shuta dharana means when we hear shastra, when we hear the teachings of Krishna and Krishna's great devotees, we hold it. We hold it firmly. And that becomes the path of our life. So that's what it means. Shuta dharana, which Prabhupada translates as those who have taken to the idea of the Lord by hearing about him. And yay just means those who. So tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana jay.
Tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana jay.
So now we'll chant this. Devai vidantya titaranti cha deva mayam.
Devai vidantya titaranti cha deva mayam.
Devai vidantya titaranti cha deva mayam. Sri Shudra Huna Savara Api Papa Jiva.
Sri Shudra Huna
Savara
Api Papa Jiva.
Yad Yad Bhuta Krama Parayana Shila Shikshas. Yad yad bhuta krama parayana shila shikshas.
Yad yad bhuta krama parayana shila shikshas.
Tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana je.
Tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana je.
Tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana je. So today I'd like to request the ladies to chant first, and then the men, who are all gentlemen, I know.
Devai vidantya titaranti cha deva mayam.
Sri Shudra Huna Shavara Api Papa Jiva. Yad yad bhuta krama parayana shila shikshas. Tiryag jana api kimu shuta dharana je.
Devai vidantya titaranti cha deva mayam.
Sri
श्रीशूद्रहून शबरा अपि पापजीवा यद्भुताक्रम परायण शील शिक्षा हिर्यघ्ना अपि किमु सितधारणाय देवाय विदन्ते पितरन्ति च देवमायाम् श्रीशूद्रहून शबरा अपि पापजीवा यद्भुताक्रमपरायण शील शिक्षा
So, the gentleman.
Devai vidantya titaranti cha devamayam. Sri Shudra Huna Sahara Api Papa Jiva.
So the word for word, te, such persons, vai, undoubtedly, vidanti, do know, atitaranti, surpass, cha also, deva mayang, the covering energy of the Lord, stri, such as women, shudra, the labor class of men, huna, the mountaineers, shabara, the Siberians, or those lower than the shudras, api, although, papa jiva, sinful living beings, jadi, provided, adbhuta krama, one whose acts are so wonderful, parayana, those who are devotees, shila, behavior, shiksha, trained by tiryag jana, even those who are not human beings, appeal. Also, kim, what, u, to speak of, shuta dharana, those who have taken to the idea of the Lord by hearing about him, jay, those. So, Prabhupada's translation. Surrendered souls, even from groups leading sinful lives, such as women, the labor class, the mountaineers and the Siberians, or even the birds and beasts, can also know about the science of Godhead and become liberated from the clutches of the illusory energy by surrendering unto the pure devotees of the Lord and by following in their footsteps in devotional service. So Prabhupada's purport. Sometimes there are inquiries as to how one can surrender unto the Supreme Lord. In the Bhagavad Gita, 1866, the Lord asked Arjuna to surrender unto him, and therefore persons unwilling to do so question where God is and to whom they should surrender. The answers to such questions or inquiries is given herein very properly. The personality of Godhead may not be present before one's eyes, but if one is sincere in wanting such guidance, the Lord will send a bona fide person who can guide one properly back home, back to Godhead. There is no need of material qualifications for making progress on the path of spiritual realization. There's no need of material qualifications. In the material world, when one accepts some particular type of service, he is required to possess some particular type of qualification also. Without this, one is unfit for such service. But in the devotional service of the Lord, the only qualification required is surrender. Surrendering oneself is in one's own hand. If one likes, he can surrender immediately without delay, and that begins his spiritual life. The bona fide representative of God is as good as God himself, or in other words, the loving representative of the Lord is more kind and more easy to approach. A sinful soul cannot approach the Lord directly, but such a sinful man can very easily approach a pure devotee of the Lord. And if one agrees to put himself under the guidance of such a devotee of the Lord, he can also understand the science of God and can also become like the transcendental pure devotees of the Lord and thus get his liberation back to Godhead, back home, for eternal happiness. So, realization of the science of Godhead and relief from the unnecessary, useless struggle for existence are not at all difficult for the willing candidate. But they are very difficult for persons who are not surrendered souls, but only simple, profitless speculators. Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, fortunately, I did not get a controversial verse today. So, Prabhupada has very beautifully explained the process of Krishna consciousness, so I'll just recklessly dive into the controversial part here. So, this verse says, Te vai vidantyati taranti cha deva mayang. They, indeed, understand and cross over deva maya, which interestingly, grammatically, also means they understand deva maya. In other words, if someone approaches you in Manhattan on the street and wants to sell you a gold Rolex watch for $10, don't buy it. So similarly, someone who actually is intelligent, you know, I mean, we've been faked out so many times by Maya that eventually you come to the point where I'm not going to be a fool. And no matter how much it glitters, it's not really gold. So now, then here's the list. Stri, women, Shudra, Huna, Sabara, Apipapa, Jiva. Now, the whole point here is grammatical. Does the compound Papa Jiva, which is a particular type of Sanskrit compound, meaning those whose lives are sinful, or sinful jivas, does this refer to women? Prabhupada himself, now this is a grammatical point, because grammatically, it can go either way. With perfect Sanskrit grammar, one can say this does not refer to women. It does not, in other words, the people in this list are not all sinful jivas. Or if one wants, he can apply it. So it's grammatically, you can't resolve this grammatically. But it should be resolved. And the way to resolve it is Shastra. And if we look at Shastra, what we find is that there's a very large number of women who are not sinful. In fact, the greatest devotees of the Lord are the gopis. They are not sinful. The great ladies like Kunti and Draupadi and so on, there's many of them. Satyavati, underrated actually. These great souls, they're not sinful. In fact, their behavior, their character is impeccable. And therefore, to take it that women as a class are sinful would be to foolishly deny a huge part of Shastra. And Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandarbha, which is sort of the definitive Gaudiya Vaishnava statement on epistemology Epistemology from the Greek episteme, which means knowledge, not to be confused with antihistamine. So episteme means knowledge in Greek, and therefore epistemology is the philosophy of knowledge. Basically, how do you know that you know? So Jiva Goswami explains in his tattva, tattva means fundamental truth, in his tattva sandarbha, Jiva Goswami explains that our ultimate authority is Srimad Bhagavatam. Our ultimate authority is Srimad Bhagavatam. And so the Bhagavatam gives innumerable examples of women who are extremely intelligent. Just to give one example, if you know Sanskrit, in the Bhagavatam, where there are many, many prayers offered to Krishna, for example, in the Dhruva story, when Dhruva sees Krishna, he offers prayers, and when Prahlad sees Krishna, he offers prayers. And so it's a very common scenario in the Bhagavatam that someone will very seriously practice Krishna consciousness, or Gajendra, who, of course, he got fast-tracked because it was sort of an emergency. But then when he saw the Lord, he offered prayers. So if you look at all these prayers, also when Krishna, for example, comes to Hastinapura, or when he comes to Indraprastha, the people offer prayers. When he returns to Dwarka, people offer prayers. So the Bhagavatam has a large number of prayers, which are not just like, oh, Krishna, save me, but they actually, these prayers, which are also Krishna Kirtan, that Krishna is glorified in these prayers, and they contained a lot of the serious theology of the Bhagavatam, or the philosophical theology of the Bhagavatam. A lot of it is found in these prayers. And now here's the point. Often the most, you could say, linguistically and theologically sophisticated prayers come from women, which I think is remarkable. If you look at the prayers offered by women when Krishna is coming, you know, to some city or when something happens, these are obviously the most intelligent, most philosophically sophisticated, linguistically sophisticated prayers. And so if you take the Bhagavatam seriously, and if you don't, then, you know, you're a bad person. So if you take the Bhagavatam seriously, then it's clear that at 5,000 years ago, many of the most intelligent people were women, and they were not sinful. I've actually written a paper about the... it's interesting, Prabhupada mentions how women are called Mataji, but the interesting thing is, I checked Vedabase like over and over, because I didn't want to get this wrong. There's actually not a single case in the entire Vedabase, which is all of Prabhupada's documented speaking and writing, there's not a single case where he actually calls a woman Mataji, which I think is very remarkable. Also, if you actually study, if you go to Shastra, such as the oldest Upanishad, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the great Aranyaka Upanishad, which is universally considered to be the oldest Upanishad, it's called that because if by linguistic analysis, just like if you read Shakespeare and then you read Charles Dickens, you can understand that Shakespeare wrote his stuff earlier than Charles Dickens, and if you read a modern novel, then you can understand that was written more recently than Charles Dickens. And so this is linguistic analysis. Every language in the world, including Sanskrit, shows different features at different stages. Just to give one example, we use the word sadhana a lot. So the word sadhana means practice. But in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna uses the word abhyasa. Abhyasa yoga yuktena. So whenever you see the word abhyasa in the Bhagavad Gita, that's the later word. I mean, the word sadhana existed back then, but it wasn't used so much. Sadhana. Or for another example would be, we in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the word siddhanta is used a lot. Anta, from which we get the English word end, ant, end. So anta means the end or the conclusion. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, ubayor that this is the end, when he talks about too much information, ontological categories that, by the way, some people have actually said that our spiritual, I have to throw this in because it's so remarkable. There are actually some people that say that our spiritual body is not eternal, we didn't have it before, and once you get your spiritual body, it just begins to exist, and then you get to keep it forever, which is actually absurd, for the simple reason that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains right at the beginning of the Gita in chapter 2, Krishna explains that there are only two kinds of things in the world. Krishna is speaking, this is called ontology in philosophy, where you explain the nature of existence itself and the kind of things that exist. And of course, the Sanskrit word for this fundamental category of a real thing is tattva, as in jiva tattva, vishnu tattva, prakriti tattva. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, right at the beginning, nasato vidyate bhavo. Very interesting. He says, there is not of the asat, the unreal or the non-existing that which is not being, non-being. Nasato vidyate, there's no bhava. There's no true existence. And so in other words, what Krishna is saying here is like, take this building. Well, I don't want to talk about the building being temporary because it's a temple. But let's say take some house in Lachwap. It didn't exist before, and it won't exist in the future. Therefore, Krishna says it is asat. It is a material thing which does not have true existence. Sat literally is the neuter participle of the verb to be, and so it literally means being. So just like in English, being can be a verb, like I am being very patient here. Or it can mean a living being. So a participle is a verb that can function as a noun. So, any questions on this lecture? No, just kidding. So therefore, Krishna says, nasato vidyate bhavo. There is no bhava. There is no true existence of that which is asat. And na bhavo, and there is no non-existence of that which is sat. So anyway, Krishna's doing ontology here. But the reason I mention this is because according to the Bhagavad Gita, there are only two categories of existence. There are only two categories of existence. There is no third category of something which didn't exist and then comes to exist, and then exists forever. There is no such thing. There is no such thing. In fact, to emphasize that there are only these two categories, there's no third category, Krishna, although we have three tattvas, which are Vishnu tattva, Jiva tattva, and Prakriti tattva, God, the God category, the living being category, and the material nature category, there's three. And yet when Krishna is talking about the most fundamental ontology, the most fundamental categories of existence, he reduces them to two because he includes himself with the jiva directly, as when Krishna says, nate vaham jatu nasam, natvam, never did I not exist, nor you. So when it comes to fundamental categories of existence, even Vishnu and Jiva are not separate categories in that particular sense. Although obviously they're separate in other very important senses, like omniscience, omnipotence, and so on and so forth. So when it comes to what kinds of things exist in terms of their ability to exist, there are only two. There is no third thing of something which didn't exist and then comes to exist. So philosophy can be a useful thing. And that's why Prabhupada said that religion without philosophy tends to become fanaticism or sentimentalism, if not just sheer foolishness. But that's actually what Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita. So going back to the main program now, regarding the women, I don't know how I got into all that. I just couldn't resist because there's so much nonsense out there. So, back to women. Not only do we find that many of the most intelligent, sophisticated, linguistically and theologically sophisticated prayers in the Bhagavatam are offered by women to Krishna, but the Bhagavatam also gives many Krishna pastimes where women are more intelligent than men. I mean, one prominent and one thing I always mention is that Krishna lived, I think it was 125 years that Krishna, I mean, he's always living, but he appeared in this world. He was manifest for 125 years. And I think we can take it for granted that every day he did a lot of really interesting things. I mean, Krishna did not have off days. Like, sorry, everyone, I'm having an off day and nothing is really happening today. So if Krishna, assuming that Krishna did very interesting things every day, 125 years times 365, that's a lot of lila. What that means is that the pastimes we actually get in the 10th canto and a little bit in the 11th canto are highly, highly selected. This is a tiny fraction of what Krishna did. And therefore, there is an extremely high level of intentionality in the Bhagavatam. In other words, if you have to choose between thousands of pastimes and you choose, you know, just maybe 90 chapters worth, what that means is these things were, with extreme intentionality, these things were chosen because Vyasa decided these are the most important. This is like the 1% or less than 1% of Krishna Lila that's most important for people to know. And among those pastimes, you have a case, the Dvija Patni Gan, as it's called, the wives of the Brahmins, who are clearly much more intelligent than their husbands. So, and they also had better character. They were not sinful, they were actually completely saintly. So, you know the story, Krishna's coward boyfriends were very hungry, which shows that it's completely bona fide to be very hungry in Krishna consciousness, and something we can all identify with because, you know, we're often hungry. So, for some reason, devotees really relish prasadam. So, the coward boys were hungry, and so Krishna told them, nearby there's a little Brahmin village with some Brahmins performing a sacrifice, and so go ask them for prasadam, because they've completed the offering, everything's offered. So they went there, and the Brahmins were arrogant, they totally didn't get it that, excuse me, these are the coward boys, these are Krishna's personal friends, totally didn't get it. So they refused to send the prasadam, and the boys were very unhappy, as we are when we, you know, turns out there's no prasadam left. So you can all relate to this. So then Krishna said, go back to their wives, because their wives are actually much more intelligent. So the boys went back to the wives, who were pure devotees, and who, I mean, if they could have, they would have put their whole kitchen on wheels and driven it to Krishna, but they basically, you know, they rushed with all the prasadam they had to give to the cowherd boys. And what's very interesting about this story, and I don't want to, you know, corrupt the innocent, but was one special feature in this highly selective story is that practically all the male authority figures possible forbid them to go. Their husbands, their grown sons, their brothers, their fathers, you get the whole list. It's like, you know, the whole patriarchy comes out in force. And the women basically tell all these men, eat prasadam. You know, they just... So then when the women come back, how do the men respond to these disobedient women? They apologize. They apologize. And they admit that actually you were more intelligent than us. I want to give one more example, which is from the Mahabharata. And that is this amazing scene where Kunti has already called three devas and produced begotten Yudhisthira, Bhima, and Arjuna, and then Madri said, "Can I also do this? I also want to give a son to my husband." Now, by the way, Kshatriyas needed to have sons because the life expectancy for Kshatriyas was not always very long. I mean, Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada used to quote that a Kshatriya never turns back from battle, which can be, you know, bring on early transfer of body. So therefore, kings, in order to maintain the stability of the government, which was absolutely necessary to, just to protect the people, to maintain continuity in government, they had to have a lot of sons because often sons would die in battle. So it's not just sort of crass chauvinism. So Pandu was anxious. So Madri asked if she could also use this formula, this mantra, and Kunti allowed her, but somewhat to Kunti's disappointment, Madri double-dipped. I mean, she called the twin Ashwins. And so then Pandu was thinking, oh my God, let's just keep this going because you can't have too many qualified sons, especially in the English, in the normal dictionary sense of the word demigod. The normal English sense, a demigod is a person who has one human parent and one celestial parent. But anyway, so the Pandavas are in the normal English sense of the word demigod. But when Pandu asks Kunti to call another deva, Kunti says no. He says, you know, what are people going to think of me? Do you want me to, you know, have a relationship with every deva in heaven or something? Or so Kunti says that no, that's enough. And so then, this is very interesting, Pandu says to her, he quotes this Sanskrit proverb, that a woman must obey her husband, must follow her husband, whether he is right or wrong. Whether he's right or wrong, a woman must follow her husband. And what does Kunti say? In your dreams, basically. And so... And, you know, as they say, the man, Pandu gets the last word. Yes, dear. So, but it's very interesting because what you see in the story of Pandu and Kunti, who were obviously two very exalted souls, is that these were real people that had real relationships. And as we know, and as social science proves, a relationship in which a man wants to dominate everything, it's not going to last. It's not going to be a happy marriage, and in the modern age, it's not going to last. Or if the woman wants to dominate. So there's this give and take, which Prabhupada also taught. There has to be give and take in the real world, and these are real people in the real world. So to say that women categorically are sinful would be absurd. It would not only be absurd, it would be blasphemous. It would be worse than absurd, it would be blasphemous, because a very large number of the most exalted devotees in Shastra are women, including the gold medalists, you know, the greatest devotees of all, who are the gopis. So, therefore, if we have this is called hermeneutics. Hermeneutics, means, actually from the word, anyway, won't go into all the etymology. Anyway, hermeneutics means it's an academic discipline in which you try to come up with a reasonable, rational, consistent methodology to understand a sacred text. For example, what descriptions are actually historical, which ones are allegorical, as in the Puranjana story in the Bhagavatam, which are simply, and another, which are just metaphorical. For example, in the Bhagavatam, there's a story in which it said that eclipses, lunar and solar eclipses occur when Rahu tries to swallow the sun and the moon, and the Acharyas in their purport say, well, obviously that's not really why eclipses occur. It's just an allegorical story. So there are different categories in the Shastra. And so when you try to come up with a reasonable, evidence-based way to understand Shastra, that's called hermeneutics. So in this case, we have a statement in the Bhagavatam which grammatically is ambivalent, literally. Ambi, from Sanskrit uba, means it can go both ways, ambivalent. It's ambivalent. So you cannot resolve this grammatically by looking at the literal sense of the words. So how can you resolve it? That you have to look at what the Bhagavatam or the actually teaches about the nature of women. And what the Bhagavatam teaches is that they're often, especially higher classes, often intelligent, often extremely intelligent. They often have absolutely impeccable character. They often are great souls, and so on. And so therefore, since grammatically it goes both ways, the actual Shastra requires us to take this to mean that Papa Jiva is a separate category. And the Bhagavatam is not saying that women are categorically sinful, because that would be absurd and offensive in the light of Shastra. So it's actually quite simple. And so anyway, any questions on all that? Amarendra.
The soul later on, and then you keep it.
A spiritual body, you mean?
Yeah.
People who believe they're more intelligent than Prabhupada, or people who think that they play this little game. Yesterday I said cues. They play this little game where if Prabhupada says something and spiritual about from Shastra, and you don't agree, then you immediately relegate it to the, that was just a preaching strategy category.
So you're not referring to the Christian to say, well, you have no soul if you do this.
The Christians, well, sort of standard Christian theology is that there's creation ex nihilo, which in Latin means from nothing, that the soul didn't exist and God creates the soul. This has led to a philosophical catastrophe for Christianity, and has actually led a huge number of intelligent people to reject Christian theology. Because if the soul is just now created, it becomes impossible to come up with a reasonable explanation of why so many apparently innocent people are suffering. This is called theodicy, from the Greek word theos, which is God, and dike, which means justice. In other words, trying to defend the justice of God, that even though this world is incredibly unjust on its surface, actually there is a supreme controller and there's justice. So Christianity has utterly failed to solve this problem. Now, there's one recent philosopher, Alvin Plantinga, University of Notre Dame, who gave this defense. He said that you can justify God permitting an evil if he does so to prevent a greater evil. And if God did not allow people the free will to do bad things, by depriving them of free will, he would actually perpetuate a greater evil. And actually, amazingly, some atheist philosophers actually thought this was not such a bad argument. I mean, it's a terrible argument because, and although Plantinga is, in many ways a good philosopher, because Krishna allows people to exercise free will. However, he does not allow or does not require that there be innocent victims in order for people to exercise their free will and do bad things. Because Krishna brings together a person who wants to do a bad thing and another person who has that bad karma. And so to say that the soul is created from nothing right now, there's no reason to say that. It's not to the glory of God. Like if you say that there is reincarnation, you're taking away from the glory of God. That's exactly the opposite. You're taking away from the glory of God. In fact, you're putting forth an absurd God who gives human beings only one chance to reform themselves. Because as we know, it's interesting when you learn to, if you study novel writing or screenplay writing, which I did in order to write what I'm writing, one advice that's given by professional coaches in writing is that in the real world, people don't change that much. So if you have, let's say, a hero who is like really terrible and just has an absolute total transformation, it's not believable. People can improve. People do improve. People can rise to the occasion. As someone who is just kind of a nothing can become a hero. That happens every day, but they don't change so much. And so it takes time. It takes time to go from a sinful nature to becoming a pure devotee. Why wouldn't God give you more time? There is no good reason in the world not to give people an adequate time frame to reform themselves. And so therefore, because of this irrational, fanatical insistence on the soul being created, Christian theologians have created a disaster for themselves, and something which, frankly, convinces very large numbers of educated people to reject that theology. So, anyway, I kind of got off into this, but so Krishna, what was your original question? I forgot. Okay.
Soul and there's not a soul, or the soul is at, you know, 8 months, or when you're baptized or you're born again. But you seem to be referring to people in Vaishna or Krishna conscious or Vedic strain of Vedic philosophy that says you acquire the soul at some point.
No, you acquire the spiritual body.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for the
They also
class.
Say, I just have to mention this. They also say that, you know, you don't have bhakti inside of you, although Lord Chaitanya says the opposite. And Bhakti Devi has to give it to you. This is very interesting because actually, according to the Bhagavatam, according to the Chaitanya Charitamrita, according to the Bhagavad Gita, there is no person named Bhakti Devi. It's sort of a poetic device. And there's not a single case anywhere in Vaishnava Shastra, like the Bhagavatam, where a person named Bhakti Devi came and gave someone bhakti. So that there's all kinds of interesting philosophical points. But anyway, they say that you come from the Tattvastha Shakti, the marginal energy, although there's no such place. The word Tattvastha Shakti is not a place, it's a category. It's an ontological category. So what does it mean to say I come from a category? There's no shastra that describes once Narada Muni was flying through the universe and he, you know, he came to this place called Tattvastha Shakti, and there he saw all these incubating souls. So again, we should not, that's called Occam's razor. Occam's razor, it was a philosophical principle put forward by a guy named Occam. And what he said was, do not unnecessarily multiply entities. In other words, if you can explain something simply, why make up all kinds of new categories? Now, the main argument, I just want to get this out here. I just want to testify, that was an old 60s song, that the standard argument is given, the spiritual world is so nice, you know, why would anyone leave it? And so without going into all the fallacies intrinsic in that argument, let me simply say this. It is true as a general principle, that you cannot be responsible for your choices if you're not aware of all the choices, if no one explains to you what the choices are. So Krishna says in the Gita, this material world is a miserable place. And Krishna has arranged for us to be in this world. Now, the only place in the Bhagavatam where Krishna talks about this is the fourth canto, chapter 28, text 53 and 55, where Lord Krishna twice says, you rejected me and came to this world. He says it twice. Anyway, so it's under Krishna's power that we are in the material world. Krishna would be unfair. Krishna would not be a perfect moral agent if he either arranged for or allowed for us to be in a miserable world if we didn't deserve it. Because if you give someone suffering they don't deserve, you're not a good person. And so in order for us to deserve to be in this world, we must have chosen it. If it was forced upon us, how could Krishna make us suffer for something we didn't choose? And you can only be responsible for your choice, as Krishna says twice in the Gita, you decided to come to this world. We could only be, in the Bhagavatam, we could only be responsible for this choice if we knew what the other options were. Because if no one told us there's another world, how could we be responsible for choosing this world if, to the best of our knowledge, this was the only world? And you could not have chosen to be in the material world unless you really understood the other choices. To really understand the other choices, you had to understand Krishna. Because Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that the only way you can actually detach yourself from your material desires is to see something higher. And one of the basic principles of our philosophy is that impersonalism is not a higher taste. Impersonalism is not a higher taste. Just knowing, okay, I'm just a jiva soul, that's not a higher taste. The higher taste is knowing Krishna. And therefore, how could we have fairly chosen to be in this world if we didn't know that Krishna was an option? And therefore, if you say we were with Krishna or we weren't with Krishna, in either case, it's logically required that you knew about Krishna. And therefore, I'm going to bet my marbles on Prabhupada, who said we have to go back to home, back to Godhead. And that we are all originally Krishna conscious entities, and basically exactly what Krishna says himself in the Bhagavatam in the fourth canto, eighth chapter. So, anyway, there you have it. So,
yeah, Maharaj, sorry.
Yes, go ahead. Okay.
So, in the purport of the canto 10, chapter 87, verse 1, which I think you wrote that purport. Sridhar Swami, you quoted Sridhar Swami, all the figures of speech, that the Gaunya Mukhya Vritti, Lakshana Vritti, and Gaunya Vritti, that it has to be used in this sense. If this doesn't apply, then that applies. If that doesn't apply, then that applies. So just, I was just reflecting on.
Yes, by the way, I wanted to mention, this is called, in philosophy, there are different, let's say, major types of epistemology. Epistemology means logical ways in which you can justify saying you know something. In other words, when is it just your opinion? When do you actually know something? And so one of the, not the principal one, but a very important form of epistemology is called coherentism. Coherentism means that all the pieces of your puzzle have to fit together. If you have a philosophy, it cannot be self-contradictory. Self-contradiction is, a spoiler. It means you don't really have a good philosophy. So what I'm trying to present here is a philosophy which is actually coherent, which doesn't contradict itself. So, any other...
Over here.
Oh, over lady, yes.
Maharaj, does that mean that all the living entities that are here in the material world, they were originally in the spiritual world?
Krishna says that you rejected me and came to this world.
So then we can actually conclude that.
Yeah, Prabhupada said we are all originally Krishna conscious entities. In the first record Prabhupada made, he said we are all originally Krishna conscious entities. But somehow we... And Prabhupada said that all of us have to go back to home, back to Godhead.
Thank you.
By the way, the idea that we would never leave the spiritual world is based on an unstated premise, which I'll just mention, then we'll... So often arguments are based on unstated premises, and when you state the premise, you realize your argument doesn't work. And so the unstated premise and the argument that we would never leave the spiritual world is that no one would ever do something against their self-interest, knowing that it's against their self-interest. The spiritual world is part of that category. No one would ever act against their self-interest knowing that it's actually against their self-interest. And yet people do it every day. People do it every day, you know, and it's the most common thing in the world that someone realizes, I shouldn't be doing this, I know I'm going to suffer, but. So the underlying assumption is actually false, namely that no one would ever act against their self-interest knowing that it's their self-interest. Yes.
Maharaj, the definition of love with Krishna in spiritual world, according to Rupa Goswami Pad, also Prabhupada quoted this in Chaitanya Charitamrita, chapter 4, 165. Sarvata dhamsa rahita, satta pi dhamsa karani. Jo bhava bandhanam juna so prema purikirtita. If we are with Krishna in love, it cannot be destroyed, never can be. Prabhupada writes ample reason that cannot be replaced or destroyed. So if it is not destroyed, then how come the conditioned soul never experienced that?
Because the word Krishna uses in the Gita is that it is covered. It can be covered, not destroyed. When the sun is covered by clouds, the sun is not destroyed. And Krishna, by the way, makes this distinction between Prakriti and Purusha, matter and the soul. In the 13th chapter, Krishna says, Prakriti and Purusham Chaiva Vidyanadiyu Bhavapi. Know that both Prakriti and Purusha are beginningless. However, Vikaramscha Gunamschaiva Vidhi Prakriti Sambhavan. Physical nature is subject to transformations, vikara, and therefore its qualities change. Like you say, water, you know, has certain qualities, like it's liquid, it's transparent. However, when water is frozen and becomes ice, that is a vikara, that is a transformation, and with that vikara, it changes its gunas, its qualities. So it's not liquid, it's solid. Similarly, when water is heated and becomes steam, again, it has different qualities and it's a transformation. And so Krishna makes clear that the soul is not subject to transformations. The soul is never transformed. It's never changed. But Krishna says many times in the Gita, it can be covered. When you cover something, you're not changing it, you're covering it. Abhritam jnanam etena. Consciousness is covered by the eternal enemy in the form of lust. And so anyway, in my Gita guide, infomercial alert, I point out all the different places where Krishna uses various forms, avritam, covered. And that's exactly what is in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Lord Chaitanya, that nitya siddha Krishna prema. Love of Krishna is eternally established, eternally a fact. Sadhya kabuna, it is never sadhya. Now the word sadhya is the, anyway, going to all the grammatical terms, it's the same as the word sadhana. Sadhana means to practice. So we know that all the acharyas have taught sadhana bhakti. So therefore, what does it mean to say that love of Krishna is never sadhya? It's never brought about by sadhana. What that means clearly, if you understand the words, is that love of Krishna is never something that didn't exist, but then you bring it about. You bring it into existence. And so sadhya kabunai, it is never to be brought into existence, exactly confirms the first words, nitya siddha. So to say that something is never sadhya is exactly the same as saying that it is nitya siddha. It is eternally existing, and therefore it is never brought into existence. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sadhya Kabunai Savanadi Shuddha Chitte. When Chitta, consciousness, is Shuddha, purified by Shravanadi, you know, the devotional process is beginning with hearing, Koriye Udai, it awakens or it arises. The word Udai, by the way, is the common word used in Bengali. This is a Bengali statement for sunrise. For sunrise. And so, therefore, the sun doesn't come into existence. So the word Udai is indicating an analogy to the sunrise. The sun, you know, you have to be very primitive to think the sun begins to exist when it comes over your horizon. And so the word Udai, the word, and also Shravanadi Shuddha Chitte, when you purify, every word in this verse is rejecting the idea that we don't have love of Krishna. Because when you purify, for example, purify, Shravanadi Shuddha, purify. When you purify water, you don't bring water into existence. You remove everything that is not water. So therefore, every line in this verse is affirming our eternal Krishna consciousness. Nitya Siddha, eternally existing Krishna Prema. Sadhya Kavunai, never something to be brought into existence. And by the devotional process, you don't create something new, you're merely purifying yourself so that which was covered, again, perfectly consistent with the Bhagavad Gita, when something is covered, like a window is covered by dust or grime, you clean the window and then the window regains its original transparency. In fact, transparency is one of the qualities of pure consciousness, and therefore, how could pure consciousness not know Krishna? Because if you are conscious and don't know Krishna, then it's not pure consciousness. So, Shravanadi Shuddha Chitta, and your love of Krishna arises like the sun rising. The sun was always there. It just, you couldn't see it. Again, at night, you can't see the sun. Why? Because it's covered by the earth, which is exactly the word Krishna keeps using in the Gita to describe what illusion is. It's a state in which you are covered. So if your ignorance is caused by being covered, if you remove the covering, you're not ignorant. It's not about bringing something new into your head. So if you read the Gita, the Bhagavatam, the Chaitanya Charitamrita, if you see what Krishna says, if you see what Lord Chaitanya says, it's obviously the case that Prabhupada is right, that we are all originally Krishna conscious entities, and it's obviously true that what Krishna says twice in the Bhagavatam, that we rejected him and came to this world. So,
I really appreciate your thoroughly explanation. Thank you.
Yes,
can I ask you one more question?
Oh, well, first we have some ladies there. So we'll get back to you, yes.
Okay.
I want you to know I'm making a great sacrifice for all of you. I'm delaying my breakfast. And of course, you're making the same sacrifice.
So are we.
So this is getting very serious.
So once having gone back to Godhead, the living entity is still in the position to make that choice. But doesn't Krishna say once having gone,
he says it twice.
You will never return?
Yeah, he says it twice.
So then do we lose our free will?
No.
What's going on then?
Krishna is just very expert at training us.
So we come here only once into this material realm
and get
the lesson?
Krishna says, jad gatva, having gone to my abode, nani vartante, they don't return. So, I mean, there's so many things in life that we did once and we got, you know, so to speak, whooped upside the head. You know, all of us have experience of doing things and like, I'll never do that again. And in fact, we don't do it again. So we have Krishna's assurance that, yes. So anyone else? Yes.
So, because I'm getting to the sixth floor and I'm getting old, right? 60 years old almost. So I remember.
That's old. So you know you have problems when you think 60, that's young.
Yeah.
I used to think that someone at 50 was like, I was just amazed they could still breathe. Yeah. You know, but now.
So because I've been around, I have always realized actually, and I realized that actually I'm a married man and women are more intelligent than me. I realized that my wife's Guru Maharaj told me actually women is the intelligence in marriage.
You realize that that's why you're still married.
Yes. So I was just listening to you about the glories of women and all these Vaishnavis, and I live in Ishkon, around Ishkon since I was a kid. And I was just thinking that if the first 40 years of Ishkon under mostly male leadership, you know, has brought us to like a slow process of growth, according to
yes,
what I see.
According to reality.
If we change the leadership to just women, then we will advance rapidly.
Yeah, I want to. Yeah. Oh my God, this is like maybe instead of saying Mataji, we can say Wonder Woman.
Yes.
So now I think personally, I mean, Prabhupada, it, of course, the misogyny, the sexism, which was, it got kind of severe at certain times in this kind of history, and they're still sort of surviving strongholds of medievalism in ISKCON in certain places. And it was based, of course, on not understanding Prabhupada, not understanding Shastra. And in my analysis as a historian, I think it was probably the single greatest disaster in the history of this movement, because I can't even imagine how many intelligent, qualified women were sort of pushed away, either from ISKCON itself or from active service. And I know I started my, you know, my incredible latest and greatest deviation, Krishna West. And what we're finding in Krishna West is that the women, I mean, it's growing in many countries. All kinds of amazing things are happening. It's not, you don't read about ISKCON news for various reasons, but, and for example, in many countries, the level of devotees we're making, they tend to be doctors, lawyers, college professors, architects, all kinds of professional people, mostly professional people we're attracting. And so what was I going to say? I got so much into my self-glorification that time. Yes. So, okay, I know. What I wanted to say is that there wouldn't be a Krishna West without the women. I mean, they're doing, I don't want to say most of the, I mean, they're most of the leaders, but maybe they are. I mean, one of our ladies created a legal department, which is bringing all of our legal affairs into order. Another lady, Madhu Mangal's wife, is managing all of our global publications, or they're managing communication. So just by looking at Krishna West and seeing how, I mean, and Leela here, smile, Leela, you know, in the Bhaktivinoda Institute Krishna West house, she's, my God, I mean, she's the only one there that only her and Krishna know what's actually going on in that house. And so what we're seeing is that the women are amazing, and they're doing incredible things. And so when I think back to ISKCON, I think, yeah, I would agree with you. I think probably most of our troubles are due to marginalizing women. And God only knows how many qualified women either left or just, you know, gave up active service, were pushed away from leadership. And then how many men followed them? Because Prabhupada said the reason he allowed women into the ashrams is because if you don't accept the women, you don't get the men. And so when you push women away by sort of crass chauvinism, you not only lose, and God only knows how many qualified women, you lose the men too. And so I think that, and I'm saying this not just to, you know, because ISKCON has changed a lot. And there, I mean, here we have Mukhya, who's doing a great job, actually. I mean, actually, the lights go on every day. So, I mean, she's really doing a great job. And there are more and more women leaders in ISKCON, qualified women. But so in a sense, we lost decades of growth, We lost decades of good management. Decades were just lost. It's like you know, the 40 years that, you know, the former Hebrew slaves were wandering in the desert. And so hopefully now we can build a much more rational and successful society. So maybe just one more question, because...
Haribol.
Yes.
Maharaj. Thank you. I don't want to contradict anything you said. But it seems like during the Varnashram era,
yes,
then they tend to categorize the women as a lower board. I mean, as you know, like...
No, actually...
But can you explain a little
bit? Yeah, actually, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the first chapter, Arjuna's main argument is that if we fight this war, it will produce Varna Sankara, which literally means Varna mixing. And if you look at the Manu Sanghita, one of the main concerns in that law book is Varna mixing. Now, some amazing geniuses say that women don't have varnas. But if women don't have varnas, then what about all the shastras that say they do? What about Arjuna's concern with mixing varnas? So that a woman in a higher caste should not marry a man in a lower caste, because the woman is higher. So, what about the Brahmins in Vrindavan, near Vrindavan, that say that the wives are more intelligent? What about Pandu, who surrenders to his wife's higher intelligence? And so just to say things like that, plus one more thing I'll throw in here. Nowadays, it is not scientific to speak about intelligence in the singular. It's just not science. Because there are different kinds of intelligence. There's mathematical intelligence, emotional intelligence, abstract intelligence, artistic intelligence, philosophical intelligence, and they're different. And they're different. So, for example, women tend to have higher emotional intelligence, and that's why they're more successful in the medical industry. That's why women, for example, do better in the universities. There's actually a diversity problem in the best American universities because there's so many more women than men. So, you know, there are different kinds of intelligence, and I think what we should really do is also not force upon people a group identity. When I meet a person, whatever they are, you know, man, woman, Martian, whatever, when I meet a person, I judge them by who they are. If I meet a person and they're intelligent, they're intelligent. Just give one example and to embarrass a disciple. Ananda Mai, who's visiting from Croatia, and yesterday I gave her the Gayatri mantra, and I would, you know, say the line, and then she would repeat it, and she wasn't even looking. She actually was kind of, you know, I was thinking, wow, that's pretty gutsy. She wasn't looking at the words, she was just repeating it, and she repeated it perfectly. So in terms of phonetic intelligence, she's one of the brightest I've seen. So... So I guess we'll stop here. You had one last point, quickly.
Maharaj, it's good to have a good feeling inside Prabhupada's building, but when I go outside, facing the other groups and this, that, it's good to have also equipped with those kind of pluralistic awareness. Not that we want to fight, but we have to establish Prabhupada also outside in the heart of others. So my question is, there are a few, but one at least. This choice, free will, that verse, Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, I remember, it says, Tashyava Yatashya, you are very erudite on Sanskrit. Tashyava Yatashya Purushasya Deyava Sthane Bhavata Idancha Paraloka Sthanancha Tasmin Shandam Tritiya Sapna Sthanam Tishtanete Ubhasthane Pashyanti Idancha Paraloka Sthanancha. So the choice was there for both, in order to make for me to come here. Now you are saying that we are not fully aware of Krishna's glory, so we made that choice.
But we chose to cover ourselves, but we can also choose to uncover ourselves because we have Krishna consciousness inside. Koriye Udai, you awaken it. You awaken your Krishna consciousness.
But in origin, is there a reference that actually we were not aware of Krishna's glory? That's why we made a wrong choice.
That's not what Krishna says. So, thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. Yes, yeah.
But it was the point of view that it's good for us.
No, I understand that. Prabhupada never said the word.